Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. All Rights Reserved, 1938 by C.S. Lewis. This recording of the reading of Out of the Silent Planet was published by arrangement with the Bodley Head Limited and was produced in 1983 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. You may keep your book for 30 days from the date of receipt by you, but after that time we charge you additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Unless you are at home during the day, you will probably find it more convenient to have tapes mailed to you at your business address rather than your home. The reason is that the postman cannot leave packages if no one is there to receive them. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, call us at the number which appears on the enclosed copyright information card. Give us the name of the book and the number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. This book consists of 22 chapters and is 182 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. This is the story of a voyage to another planet. The reader had better not know which any earlier than the hero did, for this time the hero is not the usual infallible scientist, but an ill-informed and frankly terrified victim who left the Earth much against his will. Why they took him, and what he found there, and how the expedition got back, they very nearly didn't, is the matter of this book. The author writes partly in the Wellesian tradition, but is not quite so certain as Wells about the beneficence of science and the importance of the human race. His universe is dangerous enough, but leaves more room for color, legend, fun, and whimsicality than usually appears in stories of this kind. And the reader may feel that his Malacandra is the only imaginary world he has met for a long time, which he felt any real desire to visit. Dedication to my brother, W.H.L., a lifelong critic of the space and time story. Note, certain slighting references to earlier stories of this type, which will be found in the following pages, have been put there for purely dramatic purposes. The author would be sorry if any reader supposed he was too stupid to have enjoyed Mr. H.G. Wells's fantasies, or too ungrateful to acknowledge his debt to them. C.S.L. Chapter 1. The last drops of the thunder shower had hardly ceased falling when the pedestrian stuffed his map into his pocket, settled his pack more comfortably on his tired shoulders, and stepped out from the shelter of a large chestnut tree into the middle of the road. A violent yellow sunset was pouring through a rift in the clouds to westward, but straight ahead over the hills the sky was the color of dark slate. Every tree and blade of grass was dripping, and the road shone like a river. The pedestrian wasted no time on the landscape, but set out at once with the determined stride of a good walker who has lately realized that he will have to walk farther than he intended. That, indeed, was his situation. If he had chosen to look back, which he did not, he could have seen the spire of Much Natterby, and seeing it, might have uttered a malediction on the inhospitable little hotel which, though obviously empty, had refused him a bed. The place had changed hands since he last went for a walking tour in these parts. The kindly old landlord on whom he had reckoned had been replaced by someone whom the barmaid referred to as the lady, and the lady was apparently a British innkeeper of that orthodox school who regard guests as a nuisance. His only chance now was Stirk, on the far side of the hills and a good 6 miles away. The map marked an inn at Stirk. The pedestrian was too experienced to build any very sanguine hopes on this, but there seemed nothing else within range. He walked fairly fast and doggedly, without looking much about him, like a man trying to shorten the way with some interesting train of thought. He was tall, but a little round-shouldered, about 35 to 40 years of age, and dressed with that particular kind of shabbiness which marks a member of the intelligentsia on a holiday. He might easily have been mistaken for a doctor or a schoolmaster at first sight, though he had not the man-of-the-world air of the one or the indefinable breeziness of the other. In fact, he was a philologist and fellow of a Cambridge college. His name was Ransom. He had hoped when he left Natterby that he might find a night's lodging at some friendly farm before he had walked as far as Stirk. But the land this side of the hills seemed almost uninhabited. It was a desolate, featureless sort of country, mainly devoted to cabbage and turnip, with poor hedges and few trees. It attracted no visitors like the richer country south of Natterby, and it was protected by the hills from the industrial areas beyond Stirk. As the evening drew in and the noise of the birds came to an end, it grew more silent than an English landscape usually is. The noise of his own feet on the metalled road became irritating. He had walked thus for a matter of 2 miles when he became aware of a light ahead. He was close under the hills by now, and it was nearly dark, so that he still cherished hopes of a substantial farmhouse until he was quite close to the real origin of the light, which proved to be a very small cottage of ugly 19th-century brick. A woman darted out of the open doorway as he approached it, and almost collided with him.
"I beg your pardon, sir," she said. "I thought it was my airy."
Ransom asked her if there was any place nearer than Stirk where he might possibly get a bed.
"No, sir," said the woman. "Not nearer than Stirk. I dare say as they might fix you up at Natterby."
She spoke in a humble, fretful voice, as if her mind were intent on something else. Ransom explained that he had already tried Natterby.
"Then I don't know, I'm sure, sir," she replied. "There isn't hardly any house before Stirk. Not what you want. There's only the rise where my Harry works. And I thought you was coming from that way, sir, and that's why I come out when I heard you, thinking it might be him. You ought to be home this long time."
"The rise," said Ransom. "What's that? A farm? Will they put me up?"
"Oh, no, sir. You see, there's no one there now except the professor and the gentleman from London, not since Miss Alice died. They wouldn't do anything like that, sir. They don't even keep any servants, except my Harry, for doing the furnace-like, and he's not in the house."
"What's this professor's name?" asked Ransom, with a faint hope.
"I don't know, I'm sure, sir," said the woman. "The other gentleman's Mr. Devine, he is, and Harry says the other gentleman is a professor. He don't know much about it, you see, sir, being a little simple, and that's why I don't like him coming home so late. And they said they'd always send him home at 6 o'clock. It isn't as if he didn't do a good day's work, either."
The monotonous voice and the limited range of the woman's vocabulary did not express much emotion, but Ransom was standing sufficiently near to perceive that she was trembling and nearly crying. It occurred to him that he ought to call on the mysterious professor and ask for the boy to be sent home. And it occurred to him just a fraction of a second later that, once he were inside the house, among men of his own profession, he might very reasonably accept the offer of a night's hospitality. Whatever the process of thought may have been, he found that the mental picture of himself calling at the rise had assumed all the solidity of a thing determined upon. He told the woman what he intended to do.
"Thank you very much, sir, I'm sure," she said. "And if you would be so kind as to see him out of the gate and on the road before you leave, if you see what I mean, sir. He's that frightened of the professor, and he wouldn't come away once your back was turned, sir, not if they hadn't sent him home themselves, like."
Ransom reassured the woman as well as he could, and bade her goodbye, after ascertaining that he would find the rise on his left in about 5 minutes. Stiffness had grown upon him while he was standing still, and he proceeded slowly and painfully on his way. There was no sign of any lights on the left of the road, nothing but the flat fields and a mass of darkness which he took to be a copse. It seemed more than 5 minutes before he reached it and found that he had been mistaken. It was divided from the road by a good hedge, and in the hedge was a white gate. And the trees which rose above him, as he examined the gate, were not the first line of a copse, but only a belt, and the sky showed through them. He felt quite sure now that this must be the gate of the rise, and that these trees surrounded a house and garden. He tried the gate and found it locked. He stood for a moment, undecided, discouraged by the silence and the growing darkness. His first inclination, tired as he felt, was to continue his journey to Stirk, but he had committed himself to a troublesome duty on behalf of the old woman. He knew that it would be possible, if one really wanted, to force a way through the hedge. He did not want to. A nice fool he would look, blundering in upon some retired eccentric, the sort of a man who kept his gates locked in the country, with his silly story of a hysterical mother in tears because her idiot boy had been kept a half an hour late at his work. Yet it was perfectly clear that he would have to get in. And since one cannot crawl through a hedge with a pack on, he slipped his pack off and flung it over the gate. The moment he had done so, it seemed to him that he had not till now fully made up his mind, now that he must break into the garden, if only in order to recover the pack. He became very angry with the woman, and with himself, but he got down on his hands and knees and began to worm his way through the hedge. The operation proved more difficult than he had expected, and it was several minutes before he stood up in the wet darkness on the inner side of the hedge, smarting from his contact with thorns and nettles. He groped his way to the gate, picked up his pack, and then for the first time turned to take stock of his surroundings. It was lighter on the drive than it had been under the trees, and he had no difficulty in making out a large stone house divided from him by a width of untidy and neglected lawn. The drive branched into two a little way ahead of him, the right-hand path leading in a gentle sweep to the front door, while the left ran straight ahead, doubtless to the back premises of the house. He noticed that this path was churned into deep ruts, now full of water, as if it were used to carrying a traffic of heavy lorries. The other, on which he now began to approach the house, was overgrown with moss. The house itself showed no light. Some of the windows were shuttered, some gaped blank without shutter or curtain, but all were lifeless and inhospitable. The only sign of occupation was a column of smoke that rose from behind the house, with a density which suggested the chimney of a factory, or at least of a laundry, rather than that of a kitchen. The rise was clearly the last place in the world where a stranger was likely to be asked to stay the night, and Ransom, who had already wasted some time in exploring it, would certainly have turned away if he had not been bound by his unfortunate promise to the old woman. He mounted the three steps which led into the deep porch, rang the bell, and waited. After a time, he rang the bell again and sat down on a wooden bench which ran along one side of the porch. He sat so long that, though the night was warm and starlit, the sweat began to dry on his face, and a faint chilliness crept over his shoulders. He was very tired by now, and it was perhaps this which prevented him from rising and ringing the third time. This, and the soothing stillness of the garden, the beauty of the summer sky, and the occasional hooting of an owl somewhere in the neighborhood, which seemed only to emphasize the underlying tranquility of his surroundings. Something like drowsiness had already descended upon him when he found himself startled into vigilance. A peculiar noise was going on, a scuffling noise, vaguely reminiscent of a football scrum. He stood up. The noise was unmistakable by now. People in boots were fighting or wrestling or playing some game. They were shouting, too. He could not make out the words, but he heard the monosyllabic, barking ejaculations of men who are angry and out of breath. The last thing Ransom wanted was an adventure, but a conviction that he ought to investigate the matter was already growing upon him when a much louder cry rang out, in which he could distinguish the words, "Let me go! Let me go!" And then, a second later, "I'm not going in there. Let me go home." Throwing off his pack, Ransom sprang down the steps of the porch and ran round to the back of the house as quickly as his stiff and footsore condition allowed him. The ruts and pools of the muddy path led him to what seemed to be a yard, but a yard surrounded with an unusual number of outhouses. He had a momentary vision of a tall chimney, a low door filled with red firelight, and a huge round shape that rose black against the stars, which he took for the dome of a small observatory. Then all this was blotted out of his mind by the figures of three men who were struggling together so close to him that he almost cannoned into them. From the very first, Ransom felt no doubt that the central figure, whom the two others seemed to be detaining in spite of his struggles, was the old woman's Harry. He would like to have thundered out, "What are you doing to that boy?" But the words that actually came, in rather an unimpressive voice, were, "Here, I say." The three combatants fell suddenly apart, the boy blubbering. "May I ask," said the thicker and taller of the two men, "who the devil you may be and what you're doing here?" His voice had all the qualities which Ransom's had so regrettably lacked.
I'm on a walking tour, said Ransom, and I promised a poor woman...
Poor woman be damned, said the other. How did you get in?
Through the hedge, said Ransom, who felt a little ill-temper coming to his assistance. I don't know what you're doing to that boy, but...
We ought to have a dog in this place, said the thick man to his companion, ignoring Ransom.
You mean we should have a dog if you hadn't insisted on using Tartar for an experiment, said the man who had not yet spoken. He was nearly as tall as the other, but slender, and apparently the younger of the two, and his voice sounded vaguely familiar to Ransom. The latter made a fresh beginning.
Look here, he said. I don't know what you're doing to that boy, but it's long after hours, and it's high time you sent him home. I haven't the least wish to interfere in your private affairs, but...
Who are you? Bawled the thick man.
My name is Ransom, if that is what you mean. And,
by Jove, said the slender man, not Ransom who used to be at Weddenshaw.
I was at school at Weddenshaw, said Ransom.
I thought I knew you as soon as you spoke, said the slender man. I'm divine, don't you remember me?
Of course, I should think I do, said Ransom, as the two men shook hands with the rather labored cordiality which is traditional in such meetings.
In actual fact, Ransom had disliked Divine at school as much as anyone he could remember.
Touching, isn't it? Said Divine. The far-flung line even in the wilds of Sturck and Netherby. This is where we get a lump in our throats and remember Sunday evening chapel in the D.O.P. You don't know Weston, perhaps?
Divine indicated his massive and loud-voiced companion.
The Weston, he added. You know, the great physicist. Has Einstein on toast and drinks a pint of Schrödinger's blood for breakfast. Weston, allow me to introduce my old schoolfellow, Ransom. Dr. Elwin Ransom. The Ransom, you know, the great philologist. Has Jesperson on toast and drinks a pint...
I know nothing about it, said Weston, who was still holding the unfortunate Harry by the collar. If you expect me to say that I'm pleased to see this person who's just broken into my garden, you'll be disappointed. I don't care tuppence what school he was at, nor on what unscientific foolery he is at present wasting money that ought to go on research. I want to know what he's doing here. And after that, I want to see the last of him.
Don't be an ass, Weston, said Divine, in a more serious voice. His dropping in is delightfully apropos.
You mustn't mind Weston's little way, Ransom. Conceals a generous heart beneath the grim exterior, you know. You'll come in and have a drink and something to eat, of course.
That's very kind of you, said Ransom. But about the boy...
Divine drew Ransom aside.
Balmy, he said in a low voice. Works like a beaver as a rule, but gets these fits. We're only trying to get him into the washhouse and keep him quiet for an hour or so till he's normal again. Can't let him go home in his present state. All done by kindness. You can take him home yourself presently, if you like, and come back and sleep here. Ransom was very much perplexed. There was something about the whole scene suspicious enough and disagreeable enough to convince him that he had blundered on something criminal, while, on the other hand, he had all the deep, irrational conviction of his age and class that such things could never cross the path of an ordinary person, except in fiction, and could least of all be associated with professors and old schoolfellows. Even if they had been ill-treating the boy, Ransom did not see much chance of getting him from them by force. While these thoughts were passing through his head, Divine had been speaking to Weston in a low voice, but no lower than was to be expected of a man discussing hospitable arrangements in the presence of a guest. It ended with a grunt of assent from Weston. Ransom, to whose other difficulties a mere social embarrassment was now being added, turned with the idea of making some remark. But Weston was now speaking to the boy. "You've given enough trouble for one night, Harry," he said, "and in a properly governed country I'd know how to deal with you. Hold your tongue and stop snivelling. You needn't go into the wash-house if you don't want..."
"It weren't the wash-house," sobbed the half-wit. "You know it weren't. I don't want to go in that thing again."
"He means the laboratory," interrupted Divine. "He got in there and was shut in by accident for a few hours once. It put the wind up him for some reason.
Lo, the poor Indian, you know."
He turned to the boy. "Listen, Harry," he said, "this kind gentleman is going to take you home as soon as he's had a rest. If you'll come in and sit down quietly in the hall, I'll give you something you like." He imitated the noise of a cork being drawn from a bottle. Ransom remembered it had been one of Divine's tricks at school, and a guffaw of infantile knowingness broke from Harry's lips.
"Bring him in," said Weston as he turned away and disappeared into the house.
Ransom hesitated to follow,
but Devine assured him that Weston would be very glad to see him. The lie was barefaced, but Ransom's desire for a rest and a drink were rapidly overcoming his social scruples. Preceded by Devine and Harry, he entered the house and found himself a moment later seated in an armchair and awaiting the return of Devine, who had gone to fetch refreshments. Chapter 2. The room into which he had been shown revealed a strange mixture of luxury and squalor. The windows were shuttered and curtainless. The floor was uncarpeted and strewn with packing cases, shavings, newspapers, and boots, and the wallpaper showed the stains left by the pictures and furniture of the previous occupants. On the other hand, the only two armchairs were of the costliest type, and in the litter which covered the tables, cigars, oyster shells, and empty champagne bottles, jostled with tins of condensed milk and open sardine tins, with cheap crockery, broken bread, and teacups a quarter full of tea and cigarette ends. His hosts seemed to be a long time away, and Ransom fell to thinking of Devine. He felt for him that sort of distaste we feel for someone whom we have admired in boyhood for a very brief period, and then outgrown. Devine had learned just half a term earlier than anyone else that kind of humor which consists in a perpetual parody of the sentimental or idealistic clichés of one's elders. For a few weeks his references to the dear old place and to playing the game, to the white man's burden and a straight bat, had swept everyone, Ransom included, off their feet. But before he left Wedenshaw, Ransom had already begun to find Devine a bore, and at Cambridge he had avoided him, wondering from afar how anyone so flashy and, as it were, ready-made could be so successful. Then had come the mystery of Devine's election to the Leicester Fellowship, and the further mystery of his increasing wealth. He had long since abandoned Cambridge for London, and was presumably something in the city. One heard of him occasionally, and one's informant usually ended either by saying, "A damn clever chap, Devine, in his own way," or else by observing plaintively, "It's a mystery to me how that man has got where he is." As far as Ransom could gather from their brief conversation in the yard, his old schoolfellow had altered very little. He was interrupted by the opening of the door. Devine entered alone, carrying a bottle of whiskey on a tray with glasses and a siphon. "Weston is looking out something to eat," he said as he placed the tray on the floor beside Ransom's chair, and addressed himself to opening the bottle. Ransom, who was very thirsty indeed by now, observed that his host was one of those irritating people who forget to use their hands when they begin talking. Devine started to prise up the silver paper which covered the cork with the point of a corkscrew, and then stopped to ask, "How do you come to be in this benighted part of the country?" "I'm on a walking tour," said Ransom. "Slept at Stoke Underwood last night, and had hoped to end at Natterby tonight. They wouldn't put me up, so I was going on to Stoke." "God!" exclaimed Devine, his corkscrew still idle. "Do you do it for money, or is it sheer masochism?" "Pleasure, of course," said Ransom, keeping his eye immovably on the still unopened bottle. "Can the attraction of it be explained to the uninitiate?" asked Devine, remembering himself sufficiently to rip up a small portion of the silver paper. "I hardly know. To begin with, I like the actual walking. God, you must have enjoyed the army. Jogging along to Thingamy, eh?" No, it's just the opposite of the army. The whole point about the army is that you're never alone for a moment and can never choose where you're going or even what part of the road you're walking on. On a walking tour, you're absolutely detached. You stop where you like and go on when you like. As long as it lasts, you need consider no one and consult no one but yourself. "Until one night you find a wire waiting at your hotel saying, 'Come back at once,'" replied Devine, at last removing the silver paper. "Only if you were fool enough to leave a list of addresses and go to them. The worst thing that could happen to me would be that man on the wireless saying, 'Will Dr. Elwin Ransom, believed to be walking somewhere in the Midlands?'" "I begin to see the idea," said Devine, pausing in the very act of drawing the cork. "It wouldn't do if you were in business. You are a lucky devil. But can even you just disappear like that? No wife, no young, no aged but honest parent or anything of that sort? Only a married sister in India. And then, you see, I'm a don, and a don in the middle of long vacation is almost a non-existent creature, as you ought to remember. College neither knows nor cares where he is, and certainly no one else does." The cork at last came out of the bottle with a heart-cheering noise. "Say when," said Devine, as Ransom held out his glass. "But I feel sure there's a catch somewhere. Do you really mean to say that no one knows where you are or when you ought to get back, and no one can get hold of you?" Ransom was nodding in reply when Devine, who had picked up the siphon, suddenly swore. "I'm afraid this is empty," he said. "Do you mind having water? I'll have to get some from the scullery. How much do you like?" "Fill it up, please," said Ransom. A few minutes later, Devine returned and handed Ransom his long-delayed drink. The latter remarked, as he put down the half-empty tumbler with a sigh of satisfaction, that Devine's choice of residence was at least as odd as his own choice of a holiday. "Quite," said Devine. "But if you knew Weston, you'd realize that it's much less trouble to go where he wants than to argue the matter. What you call a strong colleague." "Colleague?" said Ransom inquiringly. "In a sense," Devine glanced at the door, drew his chair closer to Ransom's, and continued in a more confidential tone. "He's the goods all right, though. Between ourselves, I am putting a little money into some experiments he has on hand. It's all straight stuff, the march of progress and the good of humanity and all that, but it has an industrial side." While Devine was speaking, something odd began to happen to Ransom. At first, it merely seemed to him that Devine's words were no longer making sense. He appeared to be saying that he was industrial all down both sides, but could never get an experiment to fit him in London. Then he realized that Devine was not so much unintelligible as inaudible, which was not surprising, since he was now so far away, about a mile away, though perfectly clear, like something seen through the wrong end of a telescope. From that bright distance where he sat in his tiny chair, he was gazing at Ransom with a new expression on his face. The gaze became disconcerting. Ransom tried to move in his chair, but found that he had lost all power over his own body. He felt quite comfortable, but it was as if his legs and arms had been bandaged to the chair and his head gripped in a vice, a beautifully padded but quite immovable vice. He did not feel afraid, though he knew that he ought to be afraid and soon would be. Then, very gradually, the room faded from his sight. Ransom could never be sure whether what followed had any bearings on the events recorded in this book, or whether it was merely an irresponsible dream. It seemed to him that he and Weston and Devine were all standing in a little garden surrounded by a wall. The garden was bright and sunlit, but over the top of the wall you could see nothing but darkness. They were trying to climb over the wall, and Weston asked them to give him a hoist up. Ransom kept on telling him not to go over the wall because it was so dark on the other side. But Weston insisted, and all three of them set about doing so. Ransom was the last. He got astride on the top of the wall, sitting on his coat because of the broken bottles. The other two had already dropped down on the outside into the darkness, but before he followed them, a door in the wall, which none of them had noticed, was opened from without, and the queerest people he had ever seen came into the garden, bringing Weston and Devine back with them. They left them in the garden and retired into the darkness themselves, locking the door behind them. Ransom found it impossible to get down from the wall. The story is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.